Hi everyone. Welcome to this session. It's the after lunch session, so feel free to come up and grab a lolly or two if you need one. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Betty from PwC, and today we've got Professor Alex Coley to speak to us about the effectiveness of standalone occupational rehabilitation programs, a systematic review. So I'll just read the first sentence of Alex's bio. So he's the CEO of ISCA, which is the Institute of Safety, Compensation, Recovery Research. He's held research leadership roles in academia, government and industry for the past 15 years. So he's got extensive experience, and I'll just invite him to come up to speak to us.
Thank you. So this is a small but elite crowd in here. This is the one to be in if you want to know about OCC Rehab. So I'm actually presenting this on behalf of some colleagues at ISCA, Amanda Sampson, who was supposed to be here with us but got a better offer back in Melbourne, I think, and couldn't make it, and Anne Baker, who used to work with us at ISCA but has moved on to a university appointment since, have done most of the work, as well as Sam Barker, who gave birth last Friday, so she's got a really good excuse for not being here. She's just left hospital today, I think. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about just an initial piece of work that we've done looking at what I'm going to call standalone occupational rehab programs. And I'll explain what I mean by that as we go through. Just have to get this working. I think it's worthwhile just pausing for a moment just to remind ourselves of the burden of the problem that we're dealing with. So I'm not sure if any of you follow the ILO, but this is their latest sort of statistics on the global number of work-related deaths arising from accidents and work-related accidents annually. And it's probably a large underestimation of the problem of work-related conditions, because it only really accounts for accidents and not other work-related chronic diseases and other illnesses and those sorts of things. But nevertheless, a pretty impressive figure. And I like to compare it to the equivalent figure arising for motor vehicle accidents, which is 1.3 million, but gets a lot more coverage, I think, globally, motor vehicle accidents. What we see in work injury globally is actually a much, much bigger public health and social policy problem, yet it doesn't seem to attract the same amount of attention, in my view. In Australia, we're only anywhere between 18 and sort of 30% of all work-related injuries actually make it onto our compensation schemes, depending on which state and territory you're in. We have, according to the latest estimates from the ABS, about 530,000 work-related injuries a year. That's one every minute. Most of those are quite minor things, and a lot of them don't result in time away from work, but a lot of them do. And the rate per 1,000 people varies considerably across jurisdictions, if you believe the latest ABS data. There's also other good information, including from the Global Burden of Disease study, so which was last published in The Lancet and online now about a year or two ago. And if you look at the Australian data in the Global Burden of Disease estimates, it's really quite interesting where work-related conditions fit in. So some of the common things we see arising from work, like back pain and neck pain and musculoskeletal conditions, are three of the five leading causes of disability in Australia. And among people between 15 and 65 years of age, if you put those three things together, they create the greatest burden of disability in this country, over and above anything else, so greater than depression, mental health conditions, those other sorts of things. So things that commonly occur at work are having a big impact on the health in Australia. And you've heard a number of times over the last couple of days, and I'm sure you're all familiar with what the impacts of work-related injury. The thing that really strikes me now that I have children is the last one, and there's quite good evidence now that long-term periods of time off work actually has intergenerational effects. So if you're unemployed for a long period of time, your children are more likely to be unemployed, and their children are more likely to be unemployed and have all the sort of social disadvantage that goes along with that. And we see cases of long-term worklessness in our workers' compensation schemes, and quite a few of them receive occupational rehabilitation services. of one type or another. So this just all goes to say that having effective and efficient approaches to return to work is an important goal for society, which I'd hope you all agree with, given that you're here at this conference. Something else that we know, just to narrow it in on Victoria a bit more, which is where I do most of my work, is that we have a large tail, and even compared to some of the other states in Australia. So this is data from a publication we've just put on our website comparing outcomes... That's not working. Comparing outcomes between different states and territories across Australia. Victoria is the red line at the top there, and at 1 year post-injury, according to the data in the National Data Set of Workers' Comp Statistics, there are more Victorians still receiving income replacement benefits as a proportion of those that enter the scheme than in any other state, and that's also the case at 2 years post-injury. We see a rapid drop-off in Victoria after that, probably because of the 130-week cessation of income payments in a lot of cases, but at these long periods, these long time periods post-injury, Victoria has a large cohort of people, and they're the ones that tend to be the focus of our OCA rehab efforts. And so how does OCA rehab fit into workers' comp systems? I've been sort of puzzling over this for a while, and about a year or so ago we ran sort of a set of consultations with the OCA rehab industry in Victoria to sort of get their thoughts about what they did and what some of their questions for research would be. And that all led to this idea that we should start by doing a systematic review to try to find out what was out there in the literature. And the reason I felt that we should do that is because we have kind of a strange use of this service, I think, in Victoria and in some other jurisdictions when you think about how return to work should work. So this is a really simplified graphic just to demonstrate the set of relationships that usually occur in a work-related injury case. So this is the injured person. This is intended to be their healthcare provider, GP, physio, whoever else is involved. This is my little image for a case manager, someone on the other end of a phone typically, although it's good to see that we're doing face-to-face out there engagement here in South Australia now. And this is intended to represent the workplace. And, you know, as you all know, in the return to work process, there's all these interactions occurring. And so it's already a complex environment where we've got multiple players. And broadly, I guess I think, this is the way I think of occupational rehab, as having two ways in which it is administered within this sort of existing environment. One is that we embed it with some other service, like it occurs in this case with the case, with the insurance case management. That would be a good approach, I think, because it doesn't necessarily lead to an additional set of interactions. But what we do in Victoria is we outsource it to private OCA rehab providers in what I will call a standalone model, where the occupational rehab is provided separate of all those other existing services, and it increases the complexity, the number of interactions in that system dramatically. It's not just one additional party, it's increasing the number of potential interactions from 6 up to 10 just by adding one additional player into the market, really. So from a complexity point of view, it adds at least one additional degree of complexity, if not more, the way that we do it in Victoria and elsewhere. And then when I think about what we know about when to intervene in return to work, you know, we know that there's this sort of critical intervention window for return to work, and that the likelihood of getting people back to work is greater if we have effective interventions early on in the disease or the injury course. So if we can do things in the days or weeks post-injury, we're likely to be more effective at returning people to work. Not so effective if we're waiting months, and probably unlikely to be effective if we're waiting years. But looking at the way the Victorian system, when in this process we deliver our OCA rehab services, it's here and here typically. So we have two types of services that are typically offered. New employer OCA rehab services that usually kick in about 12 months post-injury in Victoria, and what are called original employer services, which are usually in, you know, a few months post-injury. There are efforts now in the Victorian scheme to bring those forward and do it much earlier. I haven't seen any data about whether or not they're effective or how they're going. Maybe Shane can tell us a bit later on. So this is an attempt, is attempting to be changed, but just comparing what we know about when you need to intervene to get people back to work, and then when we're providing these services, there's a bit of a mismatch. I'm not saying we shouldn't be providing extra support at these later periods of time. We should, but we probably need to think about what our objectives are at those points in time. So, just in summary, in Victoria, we typically engage OCA rehab services months to years post-injury in the most complex cases, and we deliver the services via groups that are separate to the existing participants in the scheme. So we're creating a situation that is set up for failure, I think. This is a pretty hard task. Roughly 5,000 injured workers per annum receive it in Victoria. It costs the scheme upwards of $40 million per annum now. And we have multiple OR providers. I can't recall a number that are registered, but I know there are three or four major OCA rehab providers in Victoria and a whole bunch of smaller ones. So that's kind of the landscape. If you look around the world, there are different approaches to it. And I've had some engagement with just a few other jurisdictions, including British Columbia, where they have two major programs for OCA rehab. One they call OR1, which is basically physical therapy. It's led by a physiotherapist, and it's education-supported return to work. It's pretty straightforward. And then they have another one, OR2, which is a multidisciplinary approach to OCA rehab, much more sophisticated in the more complex cases, trying to address those other issues, psychosocial and other factors. And it's provided through a set of approved clinics that WorkSafe BC keeps a fairly tight rein over. And in Alberta, in Canada, they have multiple programs on offer, from job skills profile, all the things listed up there basically, and others. And the way they run it is injured workers, once they get to a certain point in their claim or if they have certain features, they go into a return to work assessment centre. They're assessed and provided with services on a sort of tailored need basis. They sort of pick and choose the services based on the outcome of that assessment. In Victoria, as I've said, we have an approach where services are tailored to needs, whatever that means. I think that's up to the OCA rehab provider to make that call. And two major programs. So one where we're looking to engage the injured worker with a new employer, typically 12 months or more post-injury, and then one where we're trying to get people back to their original employer, usually earlier, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months post-injury, and provided through a range of providers registered with WorkSafe Victoria, following referral by an insurance agent. So there's lots of different ways to do it. I don't know that there's much... We didn't think that there was much evidence around to suggest that one way was better than the other, and we have this sort of standalone approach in Victoria, so we thought we'd ask this question, which is how effective are those standalone models of occupational rehab in returning injured people to work? And after a lot of talking, we've sort of discovered it was pretty hard to get our hands on good data that would allow us to answer this question statistically. So we decided to do a systematic review. We decided to review all of the existing publicly available research evidence to see if we could find examples where people had tried to assess this and pull that evidence together and see what it told us. And so a systematic review is just a way of summarising and making sense of existing research on a given topic. And our topic was pretty focused, and we wanted to see what had been published in the last 25 years around the world, bring it together and see if it could give us some insights into whether these standalone OCA rehab models were working or not. Going into this, I've got to say, I didn't expect to find many research projects, any published good quality or many published good quality examples of people testing this hypothesis. And to let you in on one of the findings, I was right. There aren't very many good quality published research studies about this. There are a few, but they're not very good quality. So our primary aim was to figure out if those standalone OCA rehab programs, such as the type that we have in Victoria, are effective at getting people back to work, back to paid employment. And if we could find some examples of those, we had some secondary questions as well. So what types of things were occurring in these OCA rehab programs? What sort of services were being offered? What could we discern from the existing studies? And how do these OCA rehab services interact with all of the other things that are occurring in the return to work process, with healthcare and case management and employer-led services and all of those other things? What are those sets of interactions? And how are they working? So they're the sorts of questions we wanted to answer. So systematic review, you start by setting up a bunch of inclusion and exclusion criteria, defining what you want to find and some search criterion, and put all that in a bunch of electronic databases, and they spit out studies that might meet your criteria, and then you have to physically go through and screen them all to narrow it down to the ones that you're going to include in your final study. It's sort of there's a series of methods in systematic review that are well developed now that are essentially about transparency. The intention is that other people can come along and replicate what you've done, and so you have to follow a fairly systematic process, hence the name systematic review. So the first step is to search the databases for as many things as you that might be within scope of your study, then to read through those, screen out the ones that are ineligible, keep the ones that are in, then to do some sort of quality assessment on them, kick out the ones that are poor quality, keep the ones that are good quality, and then once you've narrowed it down to that final set of good quality articles that directly address your question, then you need to synthesise and summarise that research evidence and see what it's telling you. So they're the kind of steps in a systematic review. Usually, a lot of people that do systematic reviews use what's called a PICO or sometimes a PICOS way of describing what gets in and what doesn't. And here's our strategy. So the population of people, which is the P, that we're interested in is adults of working age with a work-related injury or disease who've had a period of time away from work. Injured workers, basically. We're looking for interventions that are standalone, and the way we describe that, and this was sometimes a difficult thing to discern in reading the studies, is that they had to be identifiably separate to other things that were going on in the return to work process. So if it was just added on to case management or added on to healthcare, we weren't interested. It had to be something that was separate, standalone to all those other services that were going on. That was sometimes a bit of a judgment call and hard to discern, but that's what we were trying to get our come to grips with. We were only interested in studies that had a comparison group. It's very difficult to say anything about the effectiveness of an intervention if you don't have a comparison group. So we excluded studies where there was no comparison, and the outcome had to be getting back to work, So we actually cut a lot out of things that otherwise would have made it. And a variety of different study designs we were willing to consider. We weren't interested in case studies or single reports or those sorts of things. It had to be groups of people that made it in. I won't spend time on this, but the quality assessment method we use is one that's established pretty well for sort of physical therapy interventions. There's a whole variety of different ways of measuring quality of interventions. We just chose this one because it was the one that the people doing the assessment were familiar with, and it's one that's been published a lot in the past, but basically you just screen each of the articles that come in and give them a quality rating that tells you something about the quality of the study. So as expected, we didn't find a lot of studies that met our criteria. We had 190 that sort of were potentially in, and after removing the duplicates, it actually came down, it should be 153, I think, not 33 there. Once we'd screened all the abstracts, we had 33 articles left. We excluded a bunch because they didn't meet our inclusion or exclusion criteria. We read 13 full-text articles and excluded some more because they didn't meet our inclusion and exclusion criteria, and we were left with 6 studies, really, at the end of the day. So I was right, there's not much published. There were 6 studies that we could find that met the criterion that we'd set. So that's kind of slim pickings, and it makes it difficult to say anything definitive. So rather than trying to do a sort of like a meta-analysis based on those studies, what I'm going to describe to you is our sort of narrative synthesis of what we saw in those 6 studies. Okay, so the first question that we had: are standalone OCC rehab programs effective for return to work? So 4 of those 6 studies reported no effect. So the intervention group, the group that got the OCC rehab intervention, was no better or no worse than the control group or the comparison group. 2 studies reported some sort of effect. One of those was only measuring the return to work effect at 4 weeks post the intervention, and it was just sort of statistically significant. The most impressive study was one that was a supported employment intervention in US veterans with PTSD, and they measured outcomes out to 12 months post-intervention. That was probably the only really good quality study that we found. So, yeah, not much there to talk about slim pickings. Looking at what models there were, we were able to broadly categorise those six studies into two different approaches, one, which we called a sort of psychosocial approach to OCC rehab, and another one that we called a workplace-based approach to OCC rehab. The studies were very heterogeneous. The types of interventions they tried differed significantly, but we were able to sort of broad categories around them. This is not definitive. It's just a way of thinking about what was done. So the sort of psychosocial approaches were usually delivered by a social worker or a counsellor or someone with those sorts of skill sets. The details of the intervention are there. So there were things like providing information about the condition, counselling, motivational support, sometimes CBT, focused on some of the conditions or some of the mental health issues being exhibited. That sort of... So the intention is that the OCC rehab interventions were addressing the sort of psychosocial factors in return to work. The frequency and duration of the interventions varied significantly. There's one here, the second one there, where there was an initial counselling session plus group training 2 to 3 hours every day for 3 weeks, so quite intensive over a short period of time. And there's another one, I think on the next slide, where there was really only just one sort of episode of contact, and that was the intervention. So they varied a lot in the frequency and the duration of the intervention. These are the sort of the workplace-based ones, and they were actually pretty hard to put them in this category. They were quite diverse, but usually they had some sort of more direct engagement with the workplace. So one of them didn't even report the frequency. The duration of the intervention was, you know, varied again, and the person delivering these interventions was a bit different to the sort of psychosocial interventions previously. So it's actually quite difficult to place them into large categories when you've got so few studies, but that's a rough approach that we came up with. The third question that we had was, how do they interact with other rehab and case management services? And it's just not possible to say. Four of the six studies didn't even report any of that detail, didn't talk about whether this, how they interacted with those other services, and the two studies that did provided quite minimal detail. So really, it's just not possible to comment on the basis of this. So in discussion, what we've got a small number of studies. Most of them are relatively poor quality. They're in quite diverse study populations. We've got big differences in the types of things that are being tried across multiple jurisdictions, and we know that context matters a lot, so things that work in one jurisdiction may not work in another for a whole variety of reasons. Two of the six studies showed some evidence of effectiveness, but four of them showed no effect. So that's kind of a summary of what we found. So you can imagine what my sort of conclusion is going to be. Just looking at some of the factors that may influence the effectiveness of any return to work intervention, including these, and how they varied between the studies. So the characteristics of the workers. So four of the six studies were focused on workers with physical conditions. One of them was focused on mental health, which was that PTSD study that I mentioned, and one of them had people with both physical and mental health conditions. The intensity or the frequency of the intervention, well, we saw typically what I would describe as low-dose interventions. People weren't getting a lot of attention. There was one study that I mentioned that had daily, but it only lasted for 3 weeks. So, you know, these people weren't getting a huge amount of love. The duration varied significantly from 1 week to one study that was sort of time unlimited, virtually. And the timing of when the intervention was put in place ranged significantly. The earliest one was about 90 days post-injury. The latest one was about 12 months post-injury. So they're in that period from sort of 3 months to 12 months when it becomes obvious that people are having trouble returning to work, not surprisingly. So a whole range of variation on these factors that are important. So it's really difficult to say anything definitive. So the findings really are that the research evidence, published academic research evidence on the effectiveness of standalone OCC rehab for return to work, is limited. it's not possible, based on that evidence, to determine whether these types of OCC rehab services are effective for return to work. Now, that doesn't mean that OCC rehab doesn't work. It just means there's not enough evidence to say whether it does or it doesn't. And it probably suggests a need to take a much closer look at this and try to create some locally relevant evidence to figure out whether OCC rehab is truly having the intended effect. So why? I think it's these two factors that I described to you at the beginning. I think we're setting ourselves up for a very difficult... We're putting multiple barriers in play here, and I must admit I don't know a lot about what sorts of things are offered within the OCC rehab environment in Australia, but my impression is that it's not a whole lot different to what you would expect return to work interventions to offer. It's sort of more of the same, but a bit more attention. I may be wrong there. I just don't know. I think that's the sort of work that needs to occur. But we're certainly setting ourselves up for a scenario where we're making a complex situation more complex, and we're intervening at points in time where, even if the interventions were really effective and we did it a few months post-injury, the gains to be made are less than if we focused our efforts earlier in the course of this injury trajectory. And perhaps we should be spending a bit more effort and time earlier in that critical intervention window. So I guess the recommendations that I can make from this is probably don't stop doing anything. Like I said, we haven't demonstrated that OCC rehab is ineffective. All we've demonstrated is there's not much evidence around. It doesn't appear that, at least from these six studies, that these interventions are doing harm. No study found a negative effect. That would be quite alarming if they did. So it seems sensible to continue while gathering more evidence. And I think that's clearly where the need is to figure out whether these sorts of things are actually working, in what cases do they work, in what cases do they not work, what's the best use of these sorts of models, when should the services be delivered. All of those questions remain unanswered to me. And we can answer them through some controlled trials or through some comparative research, looking at the way these things are done across different jurisdictions. But at the moment, we're in a bit of an evidence black hole, I think, so there's really not much you can say to guide the purchases of occupational rehabilitation. There's the six studies, if anyone's interested in reading a bit more. They're the ones that were included. Thank you. That's it. I think I'm well ahead of time, are we?
So. Oh, no, we've got 10 minutes. Okay. So I guess I'd like to invite anyone with questions. I might kick off. Just curious, why is occupational rehab, why does that occur so late in the piece, in sort of the intervention window?
Well, I think it's targeted at the people that most need it. So... and that's a legitimate approach, I think. So the people who are having the most trouble returning to work or finding new employment get additional services. That makes sense. But it's what sort of services they get and whether it's effective, I guess, is the question that we're asking. Mm. And whether or not, if we could identify those people earlier, whether we'd be better off doing some things earlier in the course of their recovery. Yeah. That's my impression. I don't know exactly how this approach that we have in Victoria came to be, but my assumption would be that we're targeting this additional effort from the system at the people who most need the attention.
Mm. Yeah. Did you have a question? Do you want to step up to the mic? Identify yourself.
Yeah. Tian Chin from WorkSafe Victoria. Just to add to Alex's comment about and to your question about why the services occur a bit later, most of our workers do get back to work within 6 months. So if we were to target them very early, it's a bit hard to know which are the ones we should apply these services to. So in some ways, we do need to see a bit more evidence before we apply that service. But nonetheless, we are trying to bring them a bit more forward, you know, to have a more optimal impact.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, you wouldn't want to over-service people who are going to return to work anyway, I think. So it makes sense to target it so people who are...
Alan Clayton, I'm not quite sure what my designation is, but and it's probably more as a question of a dialogue than question. And in terms of interventions, I mean, I think what Claire Bombardier has done with the Institute of Work and Health is that the series of modalities that have intervention, that most of them actually mimic the healing curve, and in fact, not that. In terms of early intervention, I think the evidence is that it's employer contact, maintaining contact with the worker, saying you're welcome back, and that. So that's the type of, in terms of intervention, it might be, it's not a placebo, but it is just the fact that there is that contact is probably the most effective form of earlier intervention until you see what doesn't go according to plan back into workplace reintegration, and then you bring the other services. And I'm not surprised that the Davis study was the one with the most correlative to impact, in that work that Mark Considine has done at Melbourne University on a six-country comparative return to employment area is that it is the more active employment creation, and even at the wider end where people have been workplace disengaged for years, that if you get somebody back into work and they remain back at work, future employers are prepared to disregard all the previous history. So in fact, and when I did the South Australian view, the most dramatic thing I found was a thing called Vision 100, which was 100 workers disengaged from work for up to 6 years, a team of very talented New Zealand workers who'd been experienced with substance abuse and the like, with an employer who said, if you go through this six-week course, there's a job for you at the end. Of that initial 186 were in employment. So I think, yeah, following on from what was done earlier, if we're taking a public health model approach, if we're dealing with problems directly, I think some of the approaches are really just under our noses.
Yeah, I agree. So there's a lot in there, Alan. So if I can just comment on a couple of things. I mean, what we've done here is taken one part, one small part of the system and looked at it in isolation. And so we shouldn't be fooled by that, I think. You know, the problem of return to work is a much greater one that involves lots of other different participants, and there are things that we can and should be doing based on other evidence, I think, that we're not, that would probably reduce the need for these sorts of services anyway. So we've just finished with the Institute of Work and Health updating the systematic review of workplace-based interventions for return to work, and it does show, one of the things it shows is that the most effective thing a workplace can do is offer to accommodate a worker, and that has positive impacts on the amount of time people spend away from the workplace and maintaining them at work when they're ill or injured already. But usually that's not enough. To be really effective, what workplaces need to do is that plus offering other services in a combined sort of way, so healthcare and other ergonomic or other case management sort of approaches. And it demonstrated to me, again, that we've tried a lot of things in the published research evidence, and what's emerging now is that it's that sort of more holistic approach led by the workplace that is proving to be effective. And some of the conversation over the last couple of days that I've been interested in is sort of increasing recognition of what employers can and should be doing. And that, I think that requires people that run injury schemes to work in partnership and with employers in a much stronger way than we have been in the past. So, yeah, this is sort of one little bit of the puzzle I don't want to overemphasise the importance of this piece of research. We just tried to bite off a little bit and look at it. But there's lots of other things that we should be considering, and things that I think now there's good evidence to suggest that employers should be doing things as well. How to convince them to do it is another question. But, yeah.
Are there any more questions? No? Oh, yes. Oh, okay.
We spend $110 million on workplace rehab, so it's a big worry for us, because it's not getting the outcomes, as you pointed out, and whether it's because it's delayed referral, that is the argument that the rehab providers use, is that it's not getting referrals on time. And I suppose I was a little bit, your connection with the provider, with the insurer, I'm a bit nervous about that. We've always talked about rehab being neutral and an advocate for the rehab process, non-advocate for different parties. And I have seen rehab providers align to the insurer a lot more, and they become an extension of the insurer rather than an independent practitioner advising. So that was the only sort of...
I wasn't suggesting that that's the way to do it. I was just saying there are different ways of doing this. Right. And the one that we have in Victoria is that standalone approach. I don't know what it's like in New South Wales.
It's a standalone approach.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the insurers are using providers really perhaps to do claims management activities.
Yeah.
They're ending up charging it as a claim cost rather than a thing.
Yeah, so I think we have to be careful about taking...
In South Australia, when I looked at it, they were essentially outsourced claims management as a way of passing costs onto the scheme, not including it in their overheads and their agent remuneration. So it was actually a way of trying to maximise insurer remuneration by outsourcing to the scheme.
So if that's the case, the question I would have wouldn't be for the OCA rehab providers, it would be for the insurers.
I think you're right. I think there are interventions that are provided by rehab providers that are great, like using work as therapy. So, systematically increasing job design, etc., to get people back to work. And I don't think that the rehab professionals have really jumped on that.
For me, that's a really interesting point, because I think... Because the sense that I get is that we're using OCA Rehab a little bit as outsourced case management, there probably needs to be greater clarity about what sort of things would we expect our insurance or our agents to be doing, and then what additional things are these agencies going to be doing that adds value to that. And I'm not sure that's been clarified. That sort of all seems to be a lot of overlap between the things that get offered. But I don't have any good evidence to support that. It's just my impression from talking to people. Which is, I'm a researcher, so I think we should have a look at that in some sort of research approach. So,
I think there's overwhelming evidence.
Yeah, there may well be. And I just think we shouldn't take this in isolation. So there is a legitimate question from the OCA rehab providers, I think, about, well, why are we getting the cases at this point in time and those sorts of things. So it's a whole of system issue. And you have to look at what's happening earlier in the piece to force us into this situation where we're spending $110 million on OCA rehab, So.
I think we've run out of time, unfortunately. Thank you for that. Will you join me in thanking the